Good morning.
Morning.
Sorry about that. A little change. I'm going to be doing a lesson this morning. It's a little different. Don Rule and I were talking about doing something different this morning and this evening. On Thursday of this week is Charles Darwin's birthday, and many in the scientific community and the evolution community, they are doing making a special effort to put this information out there. And they're having special things going on. It's Darwin's Day, they're calling it. And so Don came up with the idea. Don suggested that maybe both him and I this morning do a lesson a little differently, that we do lessons dealing with creation, evolution, something to this effect. So that's what we're both going to do. This morning I'll do this, and Don this evening will do a lesson also sticking with the same theme. My lesson this morning is entitled Natural Laws of Genesis 1. So if you do have your Bibles and you want to follow along there, please turn to Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to be talking about three different natural laws that are seen or demonstrated to some point or another in Genesis chapter 1. And I'll add this little piece of information real quickly. You could also add other natural laws to this as well. But three that I'm going to be speaking about this morning are the second law of thermodynamics, the law of cause and effect, and the law of biogenesis. The second law of thermodynamics is also known as entropy. And we'll talk about what that means a little bit more in a second. But if you notice in Genesis chapter 1, in verse 1, you've read this verse a million times, you've seen it, you probably look at it and you just almost, if you're like me, you almost just take it for granted. Genesis chapter 1, 1. You can say it without even actually digesting what it's saying if you're not careful, because you just know it so well. But there are so many things in that one single verse, so much power in that one single verse, that I kind of want to just talk about it for a minute. It says in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, I'm going to tell you something, and it may seem extremely obvious and unnecessary to you, but here it is. Creation had a beginning. I know that may just seem unnecessary, but I'm going to try to make a point out of it. Because this is one of the natural laws that we see in Genesis chapter 1. Astrophysicist Robert Jastrow, who is a very well-known scientist, he does a lot of writing. Very respected in his field, he made this comment. He said, if there was a beginning, what came before? If there's an end, what will come after? On both scientific and philosophical grounds, the concept of an eternal universe seems more acceptable than the concept of a transient universe that springs into being subtly and then fades slowly into darkness. Mr. Jastrow says, from my point of view as a scientist and as a philosophical, and as I think philosophically, he says, it's difficult for me to think that the universe may have just popped into being somehow, that it's somehow transient, that it somehow sprung into being and is eventually going to be gone. He said, that's a hard concept. He said, if you were talking about an eternal universe, he says, that would actually be, for me, an easier thought. But he went on to say this, he went on to make this comment, modern science denies an eternal existence to the universe. Mr. Jastrow says modern science denies that the universe has always existed. Now that is a huge statement. It's a huge statement. We're going to talk about why it's so huge. Now Mr. Jastrow is going to go on to tell us that there is a number of evidences that demonstrate that our universe has not always existed. First of all, notice his quote. There are three lines of evidence as to why the universe has not always existed. First of all, the motion of the galaxies. That the galaxies are continuing to expand. He says there's the laws of thermodynamics, which we're going to be talking about the second one. But also, you could talk about the first law of thermodynamics also. And he says, and the life story of the stars. The fact that the stars themselves are burning themselves up. He says this all pointed to one conclusion. All indicated that the universe had a beginning. Robert Jastrow, the renowned astrophysicist, comes to the conclusion, based off the evidence, that the universe had a beginning. Yet what does God say in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1? In the beginning God created. Now think for a second about what's happening here. Modern science has revealed to us that the universe had a beginning. But Moses wrote this down thousands of years ago. How did Moses know this? How did Moses know that the universe had a beginning? We didn't know it scientifically until fairly recently. Why must there be a beginning? The law of entropy, or the second law of thermodynamics, in essence, it states that things get more disorderly, more random, less, more chaotic over time. Think about it from your own point of view, from your own life experiences. You park your car, you take your car, you park it out in the garage. You don't drive it. It sits there. You don't take care of your garage. You don't take care of things. Pretty soon, stuff's going to start happening to your car. It's going to start breaking down. Perhaps even weeds are going to come up through the concrete of your garage if you don't do anything about it and start themselves growing in your car, growing on top of your car. And so what you see is that if you don't put effort into cleaning up that area, into maintaining that area, it starts getting more and more disorderly, more and more random. Think for a second about your own housework. When you come into your house, if you just sit down and you don't work to maintain a properly cleaned house, a properly maintained house, what happens to your house over time? I don't know, but if you're like me, it gets dirtier and dirtier and dirtier and sloppier and sloppier. That's really simple, right? But that's the second law of thermodynamics. It states that things move from a state of order to disorder. And specifically, the truth of this law was seen because they were saying that energy gets less useful over time. And so eventually, the energy that remains, you can't use it. So the second law of thermodynamics states that things get more disorderly over time. So here's the question, or let's go back to the thing I'm trying to point out here. Creation had a beginning. If creation did not have a beginning, if creation has always existed, and if the second law of thermodynamics demonstrates that things always go from orderly to disorderly, and if our universe has always existed, why do we see such order in our universe? Why do we see such symmetry? Why do we see such organization in our universe? If the creation has always existed, then all that we would have today would be chaos. So Genesis chapter 1:1 drives and sticks and drives home the point of second law of thermodynamics, as well as the first law, which we're not going to talk about. But it says that creation had to have a beginning. Notice this next quote from Robert Jastrow. He references an article or a piece of information from Arthur Eddington. And he says, the most distinguished British astronomer of his day wrote, and here's a quote from Arthur Eddington, if our views are right, somewhere between the beginning of time and the present day, we must place the winding up of the universe. So he says that at some point in time, the universe was wound up. That it started its journey, if you will. That it had its beginning, if you will. Robert Jastrow goes on to continues. He says, when that occurred, and who or what wound up the universe, were questions that bemused theologians, physicists, and astronomers. So he says, when did that occur? Who did it? What did it? We don't know. He says, it's an amazing question. Notice this next statement. Most remarkable of all is the fact that in science, as in the Bible, the world begins with an act of creation. Did you notice this statement? Robert Jastrow says, just like in the Bible, just like in science, the world, the universe, had a beginning. But again, I'm going to ask the question that I already asked. How did Moses know it had a beginning thousands of years ago? The quote continues. He says, that view has not always been held by scientists. The view that the universe has had a beginning. That view has not always been held by scientists. Only as a result of the most recent discoveries can we say with a fair degree of confidence that the world has not existed forever. Watch this. This is, again, a powerful statement. That it began abruptly. The universe began abruptly. Without apparent cause. Now, and we're going to come back in a little bit and we're going to talk about cause. He references here that he doesn't know the cause of the universe. We're going to talk about that in a moment. He says that it began abruptly, without apparent cause, in a blinding event that defies scientific explanation. What is he saying? That the world began suddenly, we don't know what caused it, and however it began, we don't know how it happened scientifically. Hebrews chapter 1, beginning in verse 10, makes this comment. I know I'm deviating from Genesis chapter 1, but notice the Hebrew writer's words. He says, you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Now watch this. He references the second law of thermodynamics. He says, they will perish, but you remain. Watch this. They will all wear out like a garment. The Hebrew writer says that the universe had a beginning and it is wearing out. We didn't know this scientifically to be true until recent times. But the Hebrew writer wrote about it about 2,000 years ago. Moses wrote that it had a beginning about 6,000 years ago. The second law of thermodynamics. The next law that we're going to talk about. The law of cause and effect, also known as the law of causality. Again, Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Think about that for a second as you consider the law of cause and effect. And you may not be aware of what the law of cause and effect is as it's told to you, but as I talk about it, I guarantee you, you will see just the practicality of it. God created the heavens and the earth. Dr. Thompson kind of summarized the law of cause and effect for us. He says, every material effect must have an adequate antecedent. Now, what does that mean? That's some fancy words. I don't use words like that a whole lot myself. What is Dr. Thompson saying? Well, what he is saying is that everything that happens must have had something that caused it. That's the law of cause and effect. Everything that happens must have had something that caused it. Let's bring this down to something for our own life, something we can relate to. Okay, first of all, he says it has to be an adequate cause. Whatever caused this, it has to be an adequate cause. Let's say, for example, you come home and your car is mangled. It's just destroyed. And you come to your teenage driver and you say to your teenage driver, how did this happen? And they said, you know, Dad, I was driving down the road and a fly ran into me. It was crazy. Destroyed the car. You're going to say, what? That's stupid. Because that's not an adequate cause to destroy my car, son or daughter. It's not an adequate cause. Because every effect must have an adequate cause. Okay, let's take it a little further. He says it has to have an antecedent cause. Okay, so let's say you come home, your car is thrashed, and you look at your teenage son or daughter, and you say, my car is thrashed, what happened to it? You said, oh, because in a few minutes I'm going to drive it, I'm going to crash it. Okay, it's not crashed now because you're going to drive it in a minute. You see the point that Dr. Thompson is saying? Every cause must have an adequate, every effect must have an adequate cause, and the cause has to come before the effect. Your car is not crashed because in a minute your daughter's going to crash it. Your car is crashed because she or he has already crashed it. Let's talk about this a little bit. What caused this? Now you guys may recognize some of these pictures, one of these pictures at least. What caused this building to be destroyed? What caused this is the bridge, the Bay Area Bridge. What caused this Bay Area Bridge to collapse in 1989? I don't know. It's really a mystery, right? Okay, here you go. I'm going to suggest this is what caused it. Well, why didn't the fly destroy the building? Maybe the fly was angry. And he got mad and he got all steamed up and he started running into buildings and bridges and just taking them out. Why not? And the answer is very obvious, right? It's not an adequate cause. So every effect must have an adequate preceding cause. Dr. Thompson, again, and this is a powerful quote. He says, the universe is here. Would anybody deny that? The universe is here. Some cause prior to the universe is responsible for its existence. Would anybody deny that? Something that came before the universe must have somehow caused its existence. He goes on to say, that cause must be greater than and superior to the universe itself. That statement is a very true statement. So I want to ask the question, what would be an adequate cause to explain the universe? What would be an adequate cause? What would be an adequate cause to explain the earth? As you consider the universe, it has like sextillions numbers of stars, right? You've heard the number, I can't remember it. I think it's like 60 sextillion stars. I don't know what that is. It's a number I can't even grasp, neither can you. But it's a lot. And these stars are all structured in a certain way, all placed in a certain location. And in galaxies, they're structured and organized in a certain way. In a solar system, in our solar system, it's structured and organized in a certain way. When you look at our Earth, we have things that are structured and organized in a certain way. So what's an adequate cause to these effects? Well, I have a suggestion. This is what I believe. No, I don't believe this. But some would tell you that this is maybe an adequate cause. Not this explosion, but a explosion, right? Some would say that there was an explosion in time that caused the universe to leap into existence, that caused the earth to leap into existence. And of course we know this to be called the Big Bang Theory. Which I want to point this out real quick, and this is I'm on the law of cause and effect, but I want to go back for a second to the law of second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics again states that things move from order to disorder. But what the Big Bang Theory teaches is that from an explosion, which I'm going to ask, is that an orderly thing or a disorderly thing? It's disorderly. But they want us to believe that from a disorderly explosion, order came. So again, it defies the second law of thermodynamics. But anyways, let's go back to this. The Big Bang Theory, is this an adequate cause for the universe? The Big Bang Theory, this, notice this quote. Approximately 13.7 billion years ago, the entirety of our universe was compressed into the confines of an atomic nucleus known as a singularity. This is the moment before creation when space and time did not exist. That's kind of a summary, a capsule, if you will, of the Big Bang Theory. That the whole of the universe came from an atomic nucleus, which is so small that we can't even comprehend how small an atomic nucleus is. We can't even grasp the size of an atomic nucleus. And what they're telling us is that before the universe began, the entirety of the universe, all the stars, the Earth, everything that exists was somehow compressed by a near infinite amount of gravity into this infinitesimally small atomic nucleus. And you know, you can't help then but to ask the question, and I know you've asked the question, well, where did that come from? Well, they don't have an answer for that, but let's go ahead and run with their theory that this atomic nucleus contained everything. And then from this explosion, the universe began. This is another quote from a different source. This is not an atheistic evolutionist quote. This is a creationist quote. Notice this quote. After its initial appearance, it apparently inflated, that is the Big Bang, expanded and cooled, going from very, very small and very, very hot to the size and temperature of our current universe. It continues, and it still does to this day. The universe continues to expand and cool to this day, and we are inside of it. Incredible creatures living on a unique planet, circling a beautiful star, clustered together with several hundred billion other stars in a galaxy soaring through the cosmos, all of which is inside of an expanding universe that began as an infinitesimal singularity which appeared out of nowhere for reasons unknown. They did a great job of summarizing it, didn't they? All these precise things flying through the universe as a result of an explosion. Let's go on. So we've talked about what would be an adequate cause to the universe, to the world itself. What would be an adequate cause to life? Taking it one step further. What would be an adequate cause to intelligent life? Now, you may notice some people in there that are not very intelligent, but you still have to agree that they have some intelligence. What would be an adequate cause to intelligent life? Not just the existence of the universe, but to life and to intelligent life. What would be an adequate cause? Maybe this is an adequate cause to life. Atheist professor Michael Ruse, if you have not seen the movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, I would suggest you watch the movie. Very good movie. In this movie, Ben Stein, who's the star of the movie, if you will, he is interviewing the atheist professor Michael Ruse, and he's asking him, well, how did life begin? Where did it start? And Michael Ruse throws out what is one of the theories currently. One of the current theories of how life began was it was carried on the back of ice crystals. Well, first of all, you have to ask the question, does that answer the question? It was carried on the back of ice crystals. Okay, so where did the life come from on the back of the ice crystals? So it doesn't really even answer the question. But is, again, ask the question, is this an adequate cause for life? Another theory is this. Aliens. And that is an actual working theory by some people. They actually think it's a decent theory. You guys have heard of Watson and Crick. They were the Nobel Prize winners of science when they discovered the structure of DNA. Well, it was Crick who said that he thought it was a possibility that life was seeded on Earth by aliens. He's not the only one who has said this. Again, talking about the movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, Ben Stein was talking to Richard Dawkins, one of the great atheist evolutionists in the world today. He was asking Dr. Dawkins, you know, then how do you explain that life on Earth seems to have design? You know, it seems to have intricate detail and seems to have almost a mechanic type structure to things. He was asking him about this apparent design on earth. And Dr. Dawkins made this comment. It could be that at some time earlier, or some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization, I did that on purpose. That's why I said not intelligent life, you know, whatever. Okay. A civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now that is a possibility. And he goes on to say, and that is an intriguing possibility. After the movie came out, Richard Dawkins did not like how this portrayed him. So you can go onto his own website, because he has a website, and he says, well, you know what, I was just saying that, yeah, that's a possibility, because he was pushing me. Well, why does he then add the comment, it's an intriguing possibility? Because I think Mr. Dawkins realized later on that he just gave credence to the idea and the thought that life on Earth demonstrates intelligent design. And as he watched that movie, I don't think he liked that one bit, so he tries to go back and retract, but I don't think he does a very good job retracting, but you're more than welcome to go back and read it yourself. But is this an adequate cause to explain life? I don't think so. But let's ask the question one more time. Is God an adequate cause to explain life? Remember what we talked about, the law of cause and effect, that it has to come before the event. Does God come before the event in time? Absolutely. Is God greater than the event, therefore He is an adequate cause to the event? Absolutely. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Notice again a quote from Robert Jastrow, the astrophysicist. He says science, unlike the Bible. Now earlier he said science was like the Bible. He said science and the Bible both have this agreement that the universe has a beginning. But now he says science, unlike the Bible, has no explanation for the occurrence of that extraordinary event. The universe and everything that has happened in it since the beginning of time are a grand effect without a known cause. Then he makes this question, an effect without a cause? That's not the world of science. It is a world of witchcraft, of wild events, and the whims of demons, a medieval world that science has tried to banish. As a scientist, what are we to make of this picture? And he summarizes it real honestly. He says, I don't know. What caused this grand event? I don't know. The third law I want to talk about this morning, we're going to be done shortly, the law of biogenesis. Again, Dr. Thompson summarizes it for us. He says the law of biogenesis is essentially the law that life comes only from preceding life of its own type or kind. Now you may think, well yeah, that's super obvious, that's unnecessary, Nathan. That's the law of biogenesis. And it may surprise you, you may not surprise you, maybe you know science somewhat, maybe you've studied it. But this has not always been a known thing. In fact, it wasn't until Francesco Redi and Louis Pasteur and some other scientists studied this just a couple hundred years ago, 200 to 400 years ago, that they realized that this is true. That life only comes from preceding life and only of the same kind. Now, you may have seen this in your own garden. You know, you go and you buy a strawberry plant and it grows artichokes. Right? No, not unless you're my wife. If you buy a strawberry plant, it better produce what? Strawberries. And you know what? When you plant a strawberry plant, if you actually get a strawberry plant, even if it's labeled incorrectly, if you get a strawberry plant, it's going to produce strawberries. If you get an artichoke plant, you know what it's going to produce? Artichokes, and that's what I had a garden full of. Artichokes, not strawberries. I don't even like them. Okay, the law of biogenesis. Notice this quote from Levine and Evers. From the time of the ancient Romans through the Middle Ages and until the late 19th century, it was generally accepted. So look at this. This is fairly recent times. It was generally accepted that some life forms arose spontaneously from non-living matters. Such spontaneous generation appeared to occur primarily in decaying matters. For example, a 17th century recipe for the spontaneous production of mice required placing sweaty underwear, no comment, and husks of wheat in an open-mouth jar, then waiting for about 21 days, during which time it was alleged that the sweat from the underwear would penetrate the husks of wheat, changing them into mice. Now, who do you think was a genius that discovered this? I'm going to suggest it was a guy who had a bunch of dirty clothes around. But this was an actual seventh. You want some mice in your house in case you didn't, in case you wanted some. Get some wheat, get some sweaty underpants, and you can have a house full of mice. There you go. But you know what? In Genesis chapter 1, beginning in verse 11, God told us 6,000 years ago, roughly, that life only comes from life and only after its own kind. Beginning in verse 11, God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruits, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. Then the next section talks about living creatures bringing forth after their kind from the waters. Then the next section, verses 24 through 25, let's read that. "And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the field according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kinds. And God saw that it was good." The law of biogenesis was seen in Genesis chapter 1 6,000 years ago. But we just discovered this within the last couple hundred years. Each according to their own kind. And you'll notice that there's a baby there with some humans, some puppies with a dog, and then I stuck on there something that's not according to their own kind, just because it was cute. But I guarantee you their parents were an orangutan and a tiger. Each according to their own kind. The law of biogenesis. It's biblically sound. We see it in scriptures. Genesis chapter 1. It's scientifically sound. We know this from science. It's observationally sound because when you go plant something, you know what you're getting. But is it evolutionary sound? Evolution teaches that at least one time, life sprang up from non-living matter or chemicals. And you know why they have to say it happened at least once? Because otherwise, where did life begin? So they have to say that life spontaneously started. Do they have any evidence for this? The only evidence they have is that you exist. Is that life exists. They say that's their evidence. Because there is life now, so it had to spring into being at some point. That's not evidence. Not evidence at all. So what is the point to all this? Why are we talking about this? What do I hope you gain from this lesson this morning? In the book of John, chapter 20, the Apostle John wrote this. He says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book." Now watch. "But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name." John tells us that the reason he recorded miracles in the book of John was so that people would believe in Jesus Christ. Why do we need to read Genesis chapter 1? Why did God record Genesis chapter 1 for us? The same reason John recorded the miracles of Christ in John 20, so that we could believe in the God of the Bible. So that we could see the truthfulness of God's written Word, written 6,000 years ago, or recorded from 6,000 years ago, probably written 4,500, 4,800 years ago. And yet we just discovered this fairly recently. I want to challenge you this week. Be ready to defend your faith. Understand why you believe these things. Have confidence in what you know. You know, the scientific community, they want to make you feel stupid. They want, in fact, Richard Dawkins actually says that people believe in God because either they're ignorant or they're evil. That's why you believe in God, Richard Dawkins says. What is that doing? It's either going to make us evil or ignorant. But the Bible tells us, the God of the Bible tells us that God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days and all that was within them. If you're here this morning and you are struggling with sin, if your faith is not what it should be, if you're here this morning and we can help you in any way, we want to help you. We want to help you with your faith. We want to help you with your walk. We want to help you any way we can. We want to invite you at this time to come forward as we sing a song that's been selected.